Welcome to Dr. Hustle, the podcast where we interview physicians and health professionals who are living at the crossroads of innovation as leaders, entrepreneurs, and artists. Our mission is to showcase the insights and skills that can help you discover the creative and leadership potential within yourself. Here's your host, Bassam Zahid.
Hey listeners, my name is Bassam Zahid, and welcome to episode 4. What if you had a staring contest with death, and he blinked first? But in order to survive the encounter, you had to sacrifice a dream that you spent more than half your life working on. How would that change your personality? How would that change your life? How would you reinvent yourself? These questions are difficult, and many of us are fortunate that we have not had to face them. But today's guest is very familiar with not only facing obstacles and illness, but rising above them. Dr. Herman Williams is the Chief Clinical Officer and Executive Vice President at RCCH Hospital Care Partners. He received his MD at Boston University, his MPH from Harvard University, and MBA from the University of Washington. He's also an author and recently published the acclaimed book, Clear, Living the Life You Didn't Dream Of. Dr. Williams exemplifies compassionate servant leadership, and his extraordinary example can teach us all how to overcome life's challenges with grace and humility.
So welcome to Dr. Hustle, Dr. Williams.
It's my pleasure to be here.
I've been going through your history. I've been kind of reading a lot about you. And one of the things is that you have had a remarkable career as an executive in leadership in the healthcare field, but your path wasn't necessarily straightforward. So I kind of want to jump right into how your life changed. You're 31 years old. You've spent 13 years training. You're working as an orthopedic surgeon. This is basically your dream, right?
Right.
And so you're planning your fellowship. You're about to get married. Everything's going well. Then on April 28th, 1991, at 1 p.m., you're playing basketball, and then something happens. Can you take us there?
Yeah, so let me embellish it a little bit. I mean, I've had a blessed educational life, which has really, I think, teed up a lot of the opportunities that I'm enjoying now. So I went to one of the top colleges in the country, and even though I goofed off and didn't take advantage of that and didn't get into medical school right away, I went back, retrained in a post-baccalaureate program, got into a great medical school, set some super high goals, met an incredible orthopedic surgeon named Augustus White, who was the chair of orthopedic surgery at Beth Israel in Harvard, at one of the Harvard teaching hospitals. I wrote a paper with him. I took a year off, went to Harvard School of Public Health. I rotated through the Curlin Joe Clinic with Clarence Shields, who was one of the first black orthopedic surgeons in their group. And so everything was just laid out. I got into an orthopedic surgery residency. I got engaged. And it just seemed like the world was, you know, it was just there. I had worked so hard, and it was the payoff. And then on April 28th, 1991, I had a cardiac arrest and just dropped dead during a basketball game with 4 anesthesia residents and 5 neurosurgery residents.
Wow.
And so everything just went poof.
So you collapsed on the basketball court?
Yes.
And then what happens next?
So it's just a crazy story. My wife, to be, was a scorekeeper. And apparently I was in the game for about 10 or 15 minutes. And then I pulled myself out because I wasn't feeling well. And so I came and sat on the bench next to my wife. And then she said I started foaming at the mouth and just fell over.
Wow.
And she just started screaming at the top of her lungs to the other guys who are there playing ball, you know. And it took them a while to understand that she was calling them And then they just ran over, and she just describes this whole image of these guys running over in slow motion, you know, and they grabbed me, ripped off my clothes, said no pulse, he's not breathing, and they start CPR right away. Mm-hmm. And then the EMTs get there, and they have a defibrillator, and they tell everybody, clear, get out of the way. And they go to shock, and the defibrillator's not working.
Oh.
And they're like, what? Uh-huh. So, no, it's not working. Resume CPR. So they do CPR. They had already been doing it for 5 minutes. They do CPR for another 2 minutes. Finally, the paramedics get there. And their defibrillator did work, and they were able to shock me back into normal sinus. And then they take me to Harborview Medical Center, which is where I'm training.
And this is in Seattle?
This is in Seattle.
Okay.
So, you know, they wheel in this guy, and everybody's like, oh my God, that's Herman.
Right.
So a very surreal kind of experience for everybody.
And then that was only just the start of what was kind of a long process to recovery.
Yes, a very long, very long process.
Basically, you spent up to a month, like 28 days in the hospital?
Yeah, so they put a central line in me on the basketball court, and that developed into line sepsis. And then, although they were able to intubate me in the field, when I got to the hospital, I self-extubated myself and aspirated some of my own vomit. So I ended up with aspiration pneumonia. And then while I was there, a cardiologist said, hey, we got this new procedure where we perform the surgery and we put in this device and we put these patches around your heart that will detect any abnormal rhythm. And if it's deadly, it'll automatically deliver a shock.
Right.
So in my naiveness, my wife and I were like, well, sure, that sounds great. So we agreed to that. But because of the line sepsis and the pneumonia, that delayed the surgery 10 days. And then we had the surgery. And then after surgery, I developed post-op esophagitis. So I couldn't eat. And that delayed my discharge another week. And by the time it was all done and I was able to eat, I was 35 pounds lighter, and I had been in the hospital for 28 days.
Wow. And this obviously brought your training to a halt, right?
Immediate. Yeah.
Were you ever a patient before this? Like,
never.
Never. You were like
nothing.
Peak physical condition. You know, while you're in the hospital bed going through this process, what were you thinking about this transition you made from doctor to patient?
It was just, you know, again, it was surreal, and I think I was naive. It's interesting, even though, you know, I'm a physician at that time, I just didn't realize the magnitude of this issue. I just thought, because the recovery, although it was 28 days, it was fairly basic from a cardiac standpoint. So I just thought I would recover and get back to doing my work. I had a lot of short-term memory loss, which was very frustrating also. I mean, my fiance at that time was with me for the whole hospital stay. Then she went away to go to a wedding that she had been planning. And my father and I said, look, you've been here every day for 28 days. Get some rest and go see your friend and get in the wedding. And I couldn't remember where she was.
Wow.
So like 10 times a day, I kept saying, where's Jeannie? Where's Jeannie? My father, he just drove him nuts. He had inserts all around the house that said, Jeannie's in Boston. And so I think part of that, you know, I just couldn't remember from time to time. So I probably lost some of that time. And then finally, you know, that was April. Finally, maybe around July, things started to crystallize, and I just assumed I'd get back to work.
So they put you in this experimental procedure where they give you this defibrillator, which is like a common thing now.
Right.
There have been many moments where the defibrillator gave you a hard time, to put it like.
Yes.
So how did it change your life that us young doctors and medical students might not understand, you know, that it, when we put like a machine into someone's body, what might that actually do to somebody?
Right. So again, I would say no matter how a patient is, they probably don't really understand the magnitude of a device like this. So, you know, they tell you that it will shock, but you never expect for it to shock.
Right.
And so I remember my first shock because you have no idea what it feels like. And literally, it feels like you're getting kicked by a horse.
Wow.
You know, it's 35 joules of current coming from the inside out. And it is just incredibly painful. And all I can say is, I mean, I kept thinking of a Pavlovian experiment where you never know. It's like you're in a dark room and you never know where the prod's going to come. So it literally results in pure fear. And so I was just afraid. I was so afraid of the shock. When I talk about this experience publicly, I tell people I didn't even want to say the word defibrillator because I was so superstitious. I thought that it would make me anxious. And then I get anxious and then my heart rate sped up because during those days I had extra beats all the time. I had rapid short runs. I would always be afraid I was going to get popped. From that first shock, I basically got shocked, I'd say 3 or 4 times a month.
Wow.
You know, I got 3 shocks the first month. And then we got married and miraculously I didn't get shocked. So you have these moments where you're like, oh, okay, that was aberrant. I'm cool. I'm not going to get shocked anymore. You know, we had this huge celebration. We're dancing all night and everything. And I was like, oh, bad. Okay. And then we had a wedding reception in Seattle where we invited all my nurses, all my friends, my parents, my best man, everything. We were all there.
Yeah.
And I said, I just want to thank everybody for coming. You know, you mean so much to me. And boom.
Whoa.
Boom. 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 It's like, so I got 7 shocks that night. And you're like, what? I mean, just pure torture.
Right.
You know, again, never knowing. Is that it? We finally got to the ED and they just stopped. And so every time I would get shocked, we'd increase the medication a little bit more. Because in those days, and to a certain extent, still today, everybody reacts differently. So you never know how much to give someone. So, I mean, for our listeners who are not physicians, they may not wrap their brains around this, but for those of us who are doctors, I came out of the hospital, they gave me 25 milligrams of Atenolol a day.
Yeah.
That's like almost placebo effect.
Right, right. You know?
Now I'm on 200 milligrams of metoprolol every day. I'm on 150 milligrams of mixiletine. I'm on, I think it's 125 milligrams of dofetilide. You know, so I'm on like 3 antiarrhythmic drugs to control my rhythm. But I came out of there with like 1 drug on like the introductory level. So I just kept getting shocked until they were able to titrate the medication up to the level where it was the treatment and not the defibrillator. So for the first 6 months, the defibrillator was the treatment.
Wow. So, I mean, this sounds incredibly frustrating, What do you think got you through this? Because I feel like it's an easy path into depression or into either woe is me or there's no hope for me. Did you have any kind of mantra or spirituality or support that you felt like you could lean on?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of things that played into my ability to overcome it, because I was depressed and I did a lot of crying and a lot of soul searching, but my family just brought me up to believe that, you know, there's something better. I believe in God. I prayed and prayed and I just prayed that this was not going to be the way it was going to be. It was going to be different, because we kept titrating the medication and kept playing around. We were avoiding this one medication, which is amiodarone, which now is like the life cradle of antiarrhythmics. So we avoided that. Probably had we gone to that right away, I wouldn't have experienced all that I did. I might have even finished my training, but we were afraid because at that time, the major side effect of amiodarone was pulmonary fibrosis. And I was 31. So they said, if you're going to be on this medication for the rest of your life, the chances of getting pulmonary fibrosis pretty high. Mm-hmm. So we avoided that, but I always knew there were other options. And we just struggled. We just struggled through it. And I prayed and I prayed and I prayed. And I would say, you know, I had quite a struggle getting into medical school. I had to do a lot. It was a lot of prayer. And I believed that God helped me realize what it was I needed to do to make that happen. And so I had had all that foundation of things that I had overcome in the past that allowed me to believe I was going to overcome this. And so, you know, if it was a slam dunk, if everything I did was easy, and right. You know, I'm just not that kind of guy. Everything has been hard. I've fought for it. So I think I was in a perfect mindset that this is just going to be another struggle, just like everything else. So I just prayed, man, and prayed and prayed.
And for those who might have had it easy until they hit a big, you know, roadblock.
Right. Right.
What would you say to them about any struggle they might face? You know, because one thing I kind of realized, even in medical school, was for a long time, many of the students I attended school with were like the best of the best from wherever they came from. Right.
That's right.
We all felt amazing. You know, we were, you know, usually top of our classes, nothing really stopped us. And then something like medical school or residency comes along where for the first time we aren't the best. And, you know, at the same time as we're getting older, you know, our families are getting older also, and they're having their own health issues. So now all these things start to compound. And for the first time, we're like really hitting roadblocks and we're faced with responsibility that we never had before. How do you suggest someone get through that?
I feel like we all have strengths. And I would say for someone who has had it easy is that they try and build that strength. I mean, people refer to it as your blind spot, right? Mm-hmm. So if you've never been challenged emotionally, and especially in a career like medicine where you can study all you want, but where the rubber hits the road is when you're in a room with a patient who's dying and it's up to you to figure out what's going on. That's a totally different skill. And so I would say to those people is to figure out ways to build that emotional strength, figure out ways to prepare yourself, whether it's through like a proactive meditation, whether it's reading about how people get through those moments. But those emotional moments are the things that really define us. And I don't know. I just believed in my heart that something was different. And one of the things I talk about in the book that I just take a moment now to mention to people is that there's some people that don't believe in God. There's some people who have different beliefs. I personally am Catholic, but I think it's the notion that something is greater than us. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have to be God, doesn't have to be Buddha, doesn't have to be Allah, whatever it is for you. I always refer to my best friend. He believes in the power of the universe. He believes that the universe has a positive and a negative experience to it, and that all the positive you throw out there comes back to you. Mm-hmm. And so I would say just believe that what we're experiencing here in life is so miraculous. There's something bigger than us as these flesh, right. flesh and blood people, and that there's something that you can call upon to help you get through those moments that seem impossible.
So you mentioned earlier that whenever you get anxious, you know, there's a risk of your heart rate going up and then the risk of potentially getting shocked.
Right.
Do you have a routine that you follow every day maybe that you use to prepare you for your day or to set yourself up if you feel like, all right, I'm going into a high pressure situation or I know I might get worried or something?
So I do meditate. I would like to do it every day. Again, it's a discipline I think that I'm working on, but I would suggest people meditate every day to get yourself in a low state of relaxation in anticipation of your day. I think a lot of it also has to do with determining what's important. You know, I tease my wife. For her, if someone cuts her off in traffic, she's furious. Oh, no. You know, I have learned over time, you don't know what that person is. They could be trying to get to the ER for a loved one. You know, I just try and let all of those little things go. Mm-hmm. And so it's useless stress and anxiety that puts me in a lower state, number one. Number two, I'm just at the point where I feel happy and blessed by so much that my state of mind when I leave the house is, God, what a blessing.
Wow.
It's so funny. I have all these experiences and I try and reflect on, I try and tease them out so that I can articulate to other people. So we went to dinner yesterday and I asked for something on the menu and the waitress said, we've got one left and I'm holding that for you. And I said, all right, okay. And then she came back like 10 minutes later. Oh, somebody else got it.
Oh no.
So my instinct, because it's so funny how we go to the negative and we go to the was to say, wait a minute, you promised me that last one. And I thought to myself, what if that like had food poisoning in it? And that was the way the universe was like, oh yeah, we can't let you have that.
Yes.
So I laughed at myself because I said, as funny and as foolish as that sounds, that's just a different way of interpreting it. And all of a sudden I found I wasn't angry anymore. I was like, wow, maybe I should be thankful.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So I just challenge myself. There's no reason to get upset unless somebody like takes a loved one of mine or I get injured or something that really requires some sort of remorse. I try and just, interpret it as, okay.
Right. So this kind of reminds me of Stoicism. Just the idea, not necessarily, and like you said, there are times where you it's okay to feel sad. So this isn't necessarily Stoicism that we hear colloquially, where it's like, I'm just going to be a rock here.
Right.
But one of the things you said in one of the talks you've given is that life is 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you respond to it.
Right.
Which reminds me a lot about Stoicism, because that's basically like, whatever you cannot control, it's no use getting upset about it. Just control how you feel about it.
Right. And it's not Stoicism to the extent of no emotion or mm-hmm. no remorse.
Right.
Because, you know, as an example, if someone dies, you want to be remorseful. You want to mourn that. But to torture yourself to the point where it affects your health, to me, is non-productive, as opposed to saying, you know, this person is off to a different place that we don't even understand, right. You know? That person could be in a better place. They could be like, oh, man, I'm sorry. You guys are really in hell. You're suffering. I'm not suffering. So I open myself to challenging our beliefs and trying to make it positive and happy. Mm-hmm. And I find that our society, it's our human nature to make it negative. So, again, people may laugh at me. They may say, oh, that's so stupid. You know, you're just your own little fantasy world. But that fantasy world, if you will, controls my emotional response. And it prevents me from creating a negative environment for me, because stress leads to high blood pressure, which leads to stroke and all other kinds of things, because we lament over these things. And we worry ourselves, and I just think it's unhealthy.
Right.
So it's not, I'm a rock and I don't let anything affect me. Open yourself to the possibility that maybe there's a different meaning, one that you won't understand.
Right.
I don't understand why I had all this illness and everything, but I do know now that I can make something positive out of it,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to being depressed and not working and being on Skid Row and being homeless. Because I decided I can't work.
Right.
That was a choice that I made.
So now, unfortunately, this wasn't your only cardiac event.
Right.
So in 2017, so the same year that your book came out later that year. So I imagine you were probably working on it during this time. It was the day after Mother's Day, and you had an incident in mm-hmm. the Nashville airport. Do you want to talk about that?
Right. Yeah, so just out of the blue, I felt good. I had just gotten back to working out. And the irony is, my wife was in Cleveland moving my son back home from school during one of their breaks. So I was home by myself. If I had had a cardiac arrest a day before, I would have been by myself and they would have found me.
Wow.
You know, so again, it's just the timeliness. I've just been blessed. So that morning I was at the airport, just fixing myself breakfast at the Delta Crown room. And I just went down. And the last thing I remember is I just put my hands over my chest. And then I woke up and I was on the ground and I could hear somebody had put an automatic defibrillator on me, because I could hear it saying, rhythm detected, do not shock, rhythm detected, do wow. not shock. Can you imagine waking up to that?
Yeah.
Rhythm detected, do not shock. And so I was on the floor in the Delta Crown room and they were putting oxygen on me and became alert and conscious. I would later find out that in two bystanders that they were going to do CPR. So a couple of things for me. Number one is I had basically had, between 1993 and 2017, I basically had six shocks. Three of them probably were caused by me, because I was having some arrhythmias that and the nurse kept saying, go get your blood checked. And I didn't. And it turned out my potassium was like 3. So if I had checked and I had taken some potassium, I might not have gotten those.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, for someone to have six shocks in 14 years, that is a success, okay? That's what the defibrillator is for. But what I forgot is that I'm always at risk for an arrhythmia. you know, there's always a chance that your medication could be at a low point and your risk for being defibrillated or your risk for arrhythmia is at a high point and an arrhythmia just breaks through. So what that taught me is that even though I'm on a great medical regimen, I'm always at risk. That's number one. Number two is these two people who decided to put themselves between me and presumably death, because if they had done nothing, you know, they saw me go down. They knew it was either a heart attack or a cardiac arrest. It was just amazing to me that two people would do that. And the beauty, this one guy would later tell me he hadn't had CPR. He learned it 43 years earlier when he was a lifeguard.
Wow.
So that's how long he did it. And this one woman who was the other person said that her husband had died 2 years ago and he was by himself. And she said, all I could think of is I was not going to let you die by yourself. And she cradled my head while this guy did CPR just to comfort me.
Wow. Now, in one of your talks, you mentioned a statistic by the American Health Association where you say cardiac arrest kills more than 90% of victims outside of the hospital and 75% of those within the hospital. Somehow you've had these events happen twice outside the hospital and you've managed to recover. So I'm kind of interested in the philosopher within you. How does this inform your meaning of life? You know, where do you find your purpose when you go through something as traumatic as this?
So it gives me an opportunity to turn it into something positive. So my message is exactly what you've said. One is I believe people are inherently good. And so I'm out to tell people that really we're here to help each other. Number one. Number two, I want to tell my story. And so these two resuscitations have allowed me to continue to kind of preach about the goodness that there is and about the importance of not letting a circumstance take control over you, but you taking control over the circumstance and you having the power to positively interpret something instead of going immediately to the negative. So that's my mission. I've actually developed a mission, which is to make sure that everyone I come in contact with is better off in some small way after they leave me than before they met me.
So you compiled your story into a book called Clear, Living the Life You Didn't Dream Of, where you kind of go into more depth than what we're just talking about now. And I think, one, that's a courageous thing to just be able to say, all right, here I'm putting myself out there for people to read and judge me, and you can think whatever you want. So what was the process like in crafting your story and writing a book?
It was a very long journey. I started writing the book in 2000, and it came to fruition in 2017. I just didn't know what I wanted to say. I knew it was a great story, but I didn't know, well, what does it mean? What do I want to tell people? And finally, I realized that I just wanted to tell people that you can overcome what appears to be seemingly impossible. And I wanted to tell people about the importance of crafting a mission. We all should have a mission. You know, what is it about? Especially someone like yourself who's committed their lives to the service of others. I mean, understanding that mission and knowing it, writing it on paper, and every day reminding yourself in those moments where you, you know, you've been up 36 hours and you get paged to the ER again, reminding yourself, this is my mission. This is what I'm here for. I think just reaffirms what life is all about and what makes life so special. And so when I finally figured that out, I was able to make a decision, okay, I'm going to write this book. And then I struggled because I just didn't have the time to write it. And so I met up with a woman by the name of Elizabeth Atkins, who is an author and a ghostwriter. And if it weren't for us meeting and her interviewing me I think she interviewed me about 15 hours. She put all of it on paper and she did such a wonderful job that even my best friend, he said, wow, man, I could hear your voice in that book.
And so your publishers, two sisters, writers in publishing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They call this book a self-help memoir.
Right.
So I never heard the term before. Can you explain how this book is a self-help memoir?
Yes, they are claiming that they invented that title. So it's a memoir, but it's a self-help from the standpoint of the end of the book actually has exercises in it that you can go through to help you think through some of the points that we're making. It talks about, it's called the ABCs of life, just very quickly, where A is acknowledging, you know, your circumstance. So I acknowledge the fact that I have heart disease. I acknowledge the fact that at any time I can have a cardiac arrest, but I also am not going to let that get in the way of me fulfilling my mission and doing what I can. B is for breathe, which stands for relaxation and meditation. So it talks about the concept of meditation and has a link to a meditation that was graciously given to me by a guru called Sadhguru, who is the CEO of an organization called the Isha Foundation. And their mission is to make sure that everyone knows how to do yoga, mm-hmm. And knows how to meditate. So that's there. And then C is very simply living a life of compassion. And that is just living to help others, to do compassionate deeds. And
the other thing you also had in the back of the book that I liked was a kindness scale.
Yes.
So, I mean, I kind of like this. Can you tell us about it? There's four levels.
Yeah, there are four levels. And it's funny because a friend of mine who read it, she said, God, I get it. I get it. But I don't know how to be compassionate. And so I have a kindness scale that basically says, here are levels of compassion. Level one is just a smile, the most basic gesture. And I read somewhere in a medical journal that it takes more muscles to frown than it does
yes.
to smile. So it you have to work at frowning. You know what I'm saying? So one is just a basic smile. Two is actually taking it a little farther, opening a door, speaking to someone, interacting with someone. I have in there a concept that's called the elevator test, where if I'm in an elevator with somebody else, I just commit myself. I'm not going to stand in a box with another human being and not say anything.
Wow.
So I try to think of something powerful, you know, like, what, nobody's working but us, you know?
Yeah.
Just something humorous to get it going, you know? I remember we got in an elevator, and my wife is so funny because she's so embarrassed at times. We get in the elevator, and these people, they're all dressed up. And I'm like, so where are we going tonight? You know? And they loved it, you know, because it, one, acknowledged that they were dressed up and they were in a festive mood. And so anyway, that's level two. Level three is doing something for someone, maybe using your craft. I use my power as of being a physician to help others. I tell all my friends and family, if you're ever in the hospital, tell me so I can make a phone call, because it changes the dynamics. If a doctor calls and says, hey, I'm calling on behalf of, you know, Herman, and he's there, and I just want to make sure there's a treatment plan, et cetera, all of a sudden the treatment changes, because they're like, oh my God, there's a doctor on the other side, and somebody's going to be checking to make sure we're doing the right thing. So people benefit from that expertise. You know, if you're an attorney, do something for someone legally. You know, if you're a business person and you want to, somebody's trying to get a business started, help them out with a business plan. And then lastly, level four is just the highest, to me, gesture of kindness, which is to save someone else's life.
Mm-hmm.
CPR. A very dear friend of mine actually donated her kidney to her daughter.
Wow.
Turned out she was a perfect match. I mean, what a beautiful story.
Yeah.
So it's a guide to help people know where are you comfortable in your compassion. Maybe it's just a smile. Maybe it's actually saying something. Maybe it's, God, if I had an opportunity to save someone's life, I'd do it.
And so what advice would you give other physicians or health professionals who want to tell their story? Do you suggest that they try to write it themselves or go about finding a ghostwriter or...
Right. That's something you have to determine yourself. I realize that I'm a very scientific writer, and so my writing, I thought, was not terribly interesting. And so for me, plus I didn't have the time. And I think when you write a book, you really have to have a stream of consciousness. You know, the book has got to flow. Ideally, if you could take a couple weeks off, lock yourself in a hotel room, and write a book, that'd be the best, because you're in that frame of mind.
Right.
I couldn't do that. And so I made the decision to go after a ghostwriter. And I just, again, I believe I'm on this path. And I met Elizabeth, and she immediately got it when I talked to her. We spent like 3 hours. I found her on LinkedIn, mm-hmm. you know, and we spent 3 hours on the phone just talking about the concept. And so I felt that that was the way it was supposed to be. And people are just praising the book so much. And so it's my story, but it's her words mm-hmm. that brought out the power of that story. So you got to have to figure out what's best for you, number one. But number two, I think everybody has a story. Right. Life is too complex. Everybody has a story. And I encourage people to put it out there. People like to read about vulnerability, and people like to read about heroic acts and compassion. And so if you have those stories, I think you should tell them.
Just to get back to your story, you basically had to give up orthopedic surgery because there's this risk that you might be doing surgery and you could get shocked.
Right.
And one of the themes of your book that I really like are one is of dreams that you might have. You had this original dream that unfortunately had to come to an end. But then another one that I really like is this idea of reinvention.
Right.
This idea that, you know, just because, and you kind of mentioned this before, just because one path ends doesn't mean another one can't open.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the process of you reinventing yourself? How did you make that pivot? Mm-hmm.
Part of it was I had kind of prepared myself for an alternative career when I got a master's in public health when I was in med school. So, you know, much like you're in my discussion about your work with the podcast, you're creating an alternative path at some future junction. And there was, when I was in business school, I learned this concept that I always believe it's sort of like, what business are we in? And so at some point, you may ask yourself, am I in the business of healthcare? Am I in the business of helping others? Am I in the business of communication? And so I asked myself, what am I really training myself to be? And I just felt like maybe it's not medicine. Maybe it's just the business of healthcare and improving healthcare. So I went back, got an MBA. Because I felt like my MPH was so far in the past, because people ask me, why did you go get another master's? I felt like it was so far back, I needed to refresh. So I got an MBA. Then I went into healthcare consulting. There, again, try to be a good consultant and advise hospitals on how to provide the best care. And then I realized, well, maybe it's not advising. Maybe it's actually being part of a leadership team that provides that care. So I got into hospital administration, and that's what I've been doing since. So it's really asking yourself, what is my path, and being open to the fact that it's not what you thought it was.
Right.
I mean, I'm thinking I'm going to be the next Clarence Shields. I'm going to be, you know, the team doctor for the Angels or something, you know, and look at me. It's just totally that seems so foreign to me now to be the chief medical officer for 20 hospitals. It just it's just a totally different pathway, but I had to be open to the fact that that wasn't what it was supposed to be.
Did you have a concentration for your MBA?
Yes, it was healthcare business.
Was it a difficult transition going from life in the clinical setting to life in the corporate setting?
It wasn't. And I think it was because one of my strengths is, I think, communication. And so using the healthcare background in areas like a hospital team, or when I started out in healthcare consulting, they had no doctors. So they were consulting physicians in hospitals, and they had nobody with hospital experience. Yeah. So it was perfect timing. You know, today, 17 years later, that's like, are you kidding me? You don't have a doctor on your team? So that's a given. But back then, it was a real new concept. So it was very easy to be able to say, hey, I have an MBA. I know what you know from a business standpoint, but you don't understand what I've learned as a clinician. And that really brought some power to the teams I've been on. Mm-hmm.
And so what advice or what considerations should health professionals take into account if they are interested in getting a second degree, whether an MPH or, right. or MBA?
It depends on, so if you love policy, you want to make policy, I'd go the Master's of Public Health route. Also from there, you can do epidemiology, you can do research. If you like business and you want to bring your healthcare experience to some business, whether it's a startup, whether it's pharma, whether it's hospitals, whatever, I think the MBA is the better route to go. But I think because there's such great demand, if I were advising healthcare practitioners or physicians, I'd say definitely get a secondary master's to allow you to pivot later in life, because you may not want to be practicing medicine all your life. You know, I've got friends who are surgeons and they're saying, I can't take this call anymore. I'm just too old. You know, it's tough. So it gives you an alternative.
On some level, would you consider your ascent through healthcare leadership rapid? Or do you think you really had to kind of grind it out for a long time before you?
No, I think it was rapid. I came in as the vice president for medical affairs of one hospital in 2000. Then that rapidly progressed to three hospitals by 2003. And then 2004, I became the chief medical officer for a market of five. And then in 2009, I was brought to the corporate office to be over 25 hospitals. And then I wasn't the chief medical officer, but I was a VP. And then in 2013, I became the chief medical officer of a company. Wow. And it was eight, but in the last 4 years, we've now gone to 16, and we've got four in the hopper that will probably materialize, which will bring us up to 20 by the end of this year. So it's been a very rapid ascension.
So what characteristics do you think you had that made you successful as you went through that route?
Well, I would like to think a lot of it was right place, right time, but I also think it's understanding leadership and empowering others and not being a dictator and creating a positive environment where I am and just making people want to be around you. You know what I'm saying? I just think wherever I go, I just try and make it fun and exciting, and we work hard, and it's just allowed me to rapidly progress. But a lot of that, again, I can't take away from being in the right place at the right time. And the book talks about how I was able to narrow that down to four people mm-hmm. who totally shaped my life where I am right. Reflect on those folks. Right. You know?
So who were the four people for you?
Well, one of them was Dr. Donald Parks, when I was in college and I was lamenting over racism and they don't want us here and they're burning crosses. And
where did you go to college?
I went to Amherst College in Amherst, Mass. Yes. Dr. Parks, he listened to me carefully. And he said to me, he said, let me ask you a question. Do you know who Charles Drew is? I said, of course I know who Charles Drew is. Charles Drew graduated from Amherst College, you know. He said, imagine what Charles Drew went through. What are you crying about?
Right.
He said, do you want to be a doctor? Yes, sir, I do. Then get it together and figure out what you need to do and just deal with it. And that's exactly what I did. I went back to a post-baccalaureate program. I got into med school. And then the second person was Augustus White, what I consider the father of the definitive work on the biomechanics of the spine, African-American man, the first African-American medical student at Stanford University. I mean, he's got so many firsts.
Wow.
In his history. It's just mind-blowing. But I believe he mentored me. He allowed me to publish in a peer-reviewed journal. I'm certain his recommendation and his stamp of approval got me into my orthopedic surgery residency and just was an incredible inspiration for me. Mm-hmm. When I had the cardiac arrest, I made my whole transition to healthcare consulting, and then I met a guy by the name of Hugh Greeley, who basically said, I believe in you, and I was unhappy at a company that I was working. He said, listen, I'll give you a base salary, and I'll make you medical director of peer review to oversee peer review with physicians around the country. I'll let you grow the practice. And he basically gave me the confidence and the career to move forward. And I ultimately ended up working for him. I'll never forget, I was unhappy at this one company. My wife was like 8 months pregnant. And I came home and I told her, I said, I just quit my job.
Oh, no.
She was like, what? But Hugh had made it possible and got me into hospital operations. And then in 2004, I met another guy by the name of Kent Wallace and took me under his wings, nurtured me, taught me about leadership, taught me about the importance of execution of strategy, not talk about it, but to actually execute it. That separates the men from the boys.
Yep.
And he set me up with the job I have today. And he has since left the organization, but he put me where I am today.
Wow.
And it's those four people that shaped my life today.
Wow. So, and you mentioned leadership. I'm curious, what is your philosophy on leadership?
Again, I believe in servant leadership. I believe in being humble and empowering others and to lead when you need to lead. But really, I believe in a group model. The team makes leadership decisions. And I only make a leadership decision if, as an absolute last result, if I just think, I just believe that a decision is just not in our best interest. And that has rarely happened, but just setting an example. But leading, I believe in compassionate leadership. And people follow compassionate leaders.
Now, did leadership come naturally to you, or is it something you had to work on?
Leadership came natural for me because I've been a very compassionate person, and I think that people have just migrated toward me because they know that I care.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, all a person wants to know is, does their boss care about them?
Right.
And that's why you and I were talking about residency and that experience. At the end of the day, all you want to know is, does my chief resident, does my attending care about me?
Right.
And if I believe that they do, then I'll jump in front of a train.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I don't believe it, then I got to figure out another motivation, you know? Mm-hmm.
One thing that's kind of been an issue in healthcare, and this is something, because I went to Meharry Medical College, a historically black school, right. There's this idea that the number of African-American male physicians has, or at least medical students, has dropped over the last 20, 25 years. What do you think you can do in your position that you think might turn that number around, especially as we move on? We're a country that's about to become majority people of color. Right. And so it's really important to have representation in the healthcare field that matches up with the patients.
It comes down to believing that you can do whatever you want to do. I think that somehow African American males have disproportionately been impacted by believing they can't be certain things, physicians, astronauts, politicians, whatever those things are. We have allowed people to convince us that we can. And in my book, I talk about my high school teacher who told me, "You'll never get into Amherst College, ever." Why would you say that to somebody? I'm in Amherst College, the number two school in the United States of America, and I got a C in chemistry. And my counselor told me, "You will never get into med school."
Wow.
And I believe he was saying, because black males don't become doctors. I believe that. In 1976, I think. I believe that was why.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I found out today, which is interesting, because I've spoken, I went back to Amherst to speak, and I spoke to some non-students of color, and I went to San Diego State University and spoke, and I find that there are people telling students that they can't be doctors because they don't have the grades. And these are freshmen in college.
Wow.
Man, I went through college and graduated, but made the decision to go back and correct those mistakes. So why would you tell somebody as a freshman? So now I think, I mean, now I think it's just people are just propagating myths, which I think is a reflection of their own insecurities. You know, I would not tell someone you couldn't. As a matter of fact, I looked online, and I know the internet is not the gospel, but the statistics from the American Association of Medical Colleges says if you have a 3.8 GPA, you have a 75% chance of getting into med school. Well, for crying out loud. I mean, don't tell me what I can't do. Just tell me what I need to have to do that.
Right.
And then let me figure out how I get there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think black males have disproportionately allowed those messages to impact their desire, their behavior, their enthusiasm about going after things that traditionally they have not been represented in. But we can change that. You just got to get a 3.8 GPA. You know? I mean, it's that simple, right?
Yeah, right? Just work hard.
Yeah, because I think there has been research that shows that people who have had to deal with adverse situations emotionally, environmentally, those are the people who thrive in medicine when you get into med school, when you get in and when you start dealing with patients. Those are people who can relate to those who have health issues, to those who have health disparities. So, as in my opinion, people of color and those people who are poor and people who have had to deal with disparaging situations actually have an advantage when they get to dealing with patients,
mm-hmm.
because they emotionally have overcome those things and they can be inspirational in those situations. Where, like we talked about before, people who haven't had to have anything, you know, everything came easy, had straight A's, never dealt with anything, haven't had anybody in my family die, you know,
mm-hmm.
live the life. How can you relate to a woman who comes in to see you with no prenatal care because nobody told her she needed to have prenatal care. You're like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Where, what rock have you been under? United States of America, you know, right?
Wow.
So as opposed to you and I, we're like, oh my God, of course, because that information got diluted and never got to you.
Right.
So I think that's the weird juxtaposition about it all, is that actually I think we have strengths that make us better doctors in certain circumstances. Yet we let the book part scare us away.
Speaking of books, what book?
I've got to get. Oh, I thought you were going to say I've got to get to the
no,
book.
No, I don't. Not yet.
Oh, okay.
But what books have made the most impact on your life?
There are three books that always stick out in my mind. The first one is Black Skin, White Mask by Frantz Fanon. Just probably the single most important influence on me when I was in my teens and in my early 20s, because it allowed me to understand this concept that people of color are forced to see themselves through a lens of the other, and that we're not allowed to be individuals. People will say, you know, because that one Black person did that, all Black people are like that. And I think, you know, that's what we're seeing with this administration, is they're casting the same, you know, blanket across every person of Mexican American descent. You know, they're all pimps and drug dealers,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's just the whole, Frantz Fanon talks about that. It's the whole notion of you can't be an individual, yet if you're white in the society, just because one white person gets a semi-automatic weapon and commits the most atrocious crime in the history of America and shoots all those people in Vegas, that doesn't mean has no impact on any other white male.
Right.
You know, that was just one crazy person. Yet you and I we're just viewed by the actions of other people who have the same complexion as us. So really understanding that gives you a tool not to carry a chip on your shoulder, but allows you to be able to understand how people perceive you and not get caught up. But how do I make a difference? How do I stand out as an individual? How do I show that I'm different? I am who I am, right? I'm not represented by a group. So that was one. The second one that had a major impact that I think everyone should read is a book called Healthcare Disparities at the Crossroads with Healthcare Reform by Richard Williams, who is another important African-American cardiologist mentor of mine. And he talks about the history of medicine and how it has been riddled with racist notions. You know, we have smaller brains and, you know, we're not really human. You know, we're subhuman. And again, not to carry a chip on our shoulder, but to understand how other people perceive us so that you can combat that and understand how disparities today still exist, because people have these notions in their mind about our behaviors. And so they don't expose us to life-saving techniques, as an example.
Right.
And then the last one is really about leadership. It's called The First 90 Days. I think everyone should read it. It just talks about what to do your first 90 days in any job situation. So even you, you're not in a Fortune 500 company, but it allows you to set your goals for the first 90 days, because typically you're evaluated for 90 days and then you decide whether they're going to let you be a part of the team or not. So reading that book, understanding, setting a work plan for yourself, deciding where am I going to make my mark so people know that I'm a valuable part of this team is really key.
Yeah, these are great. I'm going to have a little reading list now.
yeah. Yeah, I think the first 90 days is something you ought to peek at, definitely. And then this other one by Richard Williams, Healthcare Disparities, is very important for you as a physician of color to understand. You know, the greatest discoveries in the world were made by people who thought that we were subhuman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if people want to learn more about you, or if they want to, you know, reach out to you, how can they do that?
I think the best way is my website, which is www.clearlivingthelife.com.
Okay. And all of these things that you mentioned, your website, the links to your book, Two Sisters Writers and Writing and Publishing, we're going to have them all linked on the Dr. Hustle website.
Perfect.
With show notes so that people can go there and they know immediately how to get to where they need to get to. A couple other things. You had this one quote in a lecture you gave that I really liked. You said, the starting point of great success and achievement has always been the same. It is for you to dream big dreams. There's nothing more important and nothing that works faster than for you to cast off your own limitations and begin dreaming and fantasizing about the wonderful things that you can become. And that's by Brian Tracy, who wrote The Psychology of Achievement. To close this out, do you want to kind of talk about what that means to you?
It gets back to a couple of things we've been talking about. It's just dreaming big dreams, believing that you can be a physician, believing that you can get into med school, but setting those dreams where they appear to be unreachable, because if you don't set them, you know, you'll certainly never get them. If you don't get them, you'll stop short, maybe get something just as incredible. Or, you know, in my case, you may go, oh my God, I made it. I mean, so I just think we're all taught to dream big. And I think for, you know, people of color, at some point, I forgot where the research says the age is, but at some point, 6, 7, 8, we began to realize there's a difference, because people began to talk negatively about us and we began to feel different. And those goals and dreams began to be adjusted down. You know, you say, I want to be an astronaut, and your buddy goes, what? You're not going to be an astronaut, because they've never seen a black astronaut, right? Now you can say, I want to be president. Nobody can tell you, you'll never be president. Are you kidding me? Now, for Christ's sake, I think Barack Obama will go down as one of the greatest presidents this country's ever had. So I just think dream big. Sky's the limit. Somebody's got to do it. I remember someone told me this quote by the quarterback for the Seattle Seahawks.
Is it Russell Wilson?
Yeah, Russell Wilson said he told his dad that, you know, he wanted to win the Super Bowl. And his dad said, well, somebody's got to win the Super Bowl. Why can't it be you? Right?
Mm-hmm.
So unless you set the goals, you'll never get there.
Cool. Well, thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's been my honor, you know, and I hope, again, that I fulfill my mission. I've made an impression on somebody, and they are in some way inspired or better off than before they heard our podcast. And thank you.
When facing his illness, neurosurgeon and author of When Breath Becomes Air, Paul Kalanithi wrote, I began to realize that coming in such close contact with my own mortality had changed nothing and everything. Before my cancer was diagnosed, I knew that someday I would die, but I didn't know when. After the diagnosis, I knew that someday I would die, but I didn't know when. But now I knew it acutely. The problem wasn't really a scientific one. The fact of death is unsettling. Yet there is no other way to live. Inevitably, we will all have our turn with death. The question is, how should we spend the time we have left? Will we get lost in the anger and divisiveness we see in the media, or can we counteract that narrative by lifting up our family, friends, and community? Our guest, Dr. Williams, reminds us that having a mission, a value system, a kindness scale is helpful. It all starts with the little steps. Give someone a smile, hold open a door, or volunteer your expertise, so that when you get your chance to save someone's life, you'll rise to the occasion.
For more information about Dr. Hustle, to view today's show notes, or to contact Bassam, visit drhustle.com. If you want others to know about this podcast, please write a review at the podcast store, and please link to us on social media at Dr_Hustle on Twitter and at Dr.Hustle on Instagram. This podcast is produced by Bassam Zahid, whose other work can be found at bassamzahid.com. Thanks for listening.